The Chris Perillo Show is brought to you by Microsoft Windows Media. Download Windows Media Player 10 at Microsoft.com/Windows Media.
I'm not exactly sure how to introduce this guy because he seems to do so much. And, of course, the person I'm talking about, Cory Doctorow. And some people use his last name differently, Doctorow, but it's Doctorow. Doctorow. That almost sounds like a comic book hero.
It's from Doktorovich. It's a white Russian name that got truncated in Halifax when my grandfather immigrated.
So it's so difficult to introduce you because you seem to be known for so many different things. Your work with EFF, of course, Creative Commons, Boing Boing, DRM. I mean, pick a topic. Science fiction, of course, down and out in the Magic Kingdom. Oh, yeah. I did catch a recent article in Popular Science. So is that a regular?
Monthly column for PopSci on technology policy stuff.
And so is that the only magazine gig, or is Wired regular as well?
Wired, I'm a contributing writer, so when I have something to say, they're happy to look at it. And I have a column in Make magazine, which is the new O'Reilly magazine.
So then how would you describe, since I can't describe what you do exactly or can't say what you do, how do you describe yourself?
I'd say I'm a technologist, writer, activist, blogger, journalist.
And for your involvement with CFP, is it more on this is your passion, or are you here to support it, or is it just in that realm that is Cory?
Well, I'm not super involved with CFP. They just asked me to come and speak. I mean, the topics that I'm speaking on here, in particular last night's Pioneer Awards, was something very near and dear to my heart. I mean, we were honoring technologists who've really made a difference in the field, and you know, the guests were really esteemed. Mitch Kapoor, the honoree is Mitch Kapoor, who of course founded EFF, but also created the commercial market for PCs by inventing, you know, commercially accessible spreadsheets, and also founded the Mozilla Foundation, the Open Source Applications Foundation, has been doing work with reforming politics in DC, who observed first that architecture is politics. I mean, all of this stuff that he's done is stupendous. Patrick Ball, who invented the field of human rights-oriented statistician, where he investigates human rights atrocities on a statistical basis as a means of gathering hard evidence that can be used to put away war criminals, and Ed Felton, who is practically the model of what computer scientists should be, inquisitive, challenging of authority, bright, savagely brilliant, mentor of great computer scientists himself, and so on. That was a stupendous moment for me. I'm very proud of my association with EFF, and the awards that EFF gives out every year, these Pioneer Awards, are really a great honor, I think. And it was very good to be a part of that.
So, what kind of, talks have you been doing here? What sessions have you been involved with?
Well, I'm doing one later today. I did a speech last night at the Pioneer Awards. I did a reading and a signing at the Science Fiction Museum the night before, and I'm doing a talk later today with science fiction writers talking about the future of privacy. And it'll be interesting to see how that pans out. It's Annalie Newitz, who's the moderator. It's her show, so I'll know more about what I'm going to say when she introduces it. I tend not to do a ton of prep for this stuff. I mean, my prep is kind of blogging about it, writing about it, and so on, but I don't sit down and think about my remarks before a panel. I kind of rely on the fact that I'm deeply engaged in the subject to allow me to respond off the cuff.
So, Cory, where did it start for you? Where did it really begin, this whole involvement with all of these efforts that, the internet seems to, you know, kind of taken the world by surprise, but I can only imagine you were involved with this stuff before then.
Sure. Well, I mean, my family was both activist and technological. So my parents are communists. My dad was a professional revolutionary for a time, writing Trotskyist tracts and selling smeary newspapers with them in them on the street as part of a political group that had spun into the Young Socialist League in the late 60s and early 70s. I was an activist from a very young age. I was involved in the peace movement, the nuclear disarmament movement, in the early ecology movement in Canada, and in the pro-choice movement, and doing clinic defense and stuff. And my father was also a technologist. He was a programmer and then later a computer science and math teacher. We had PDP terminals in the house that were connected by acoustic couplers to the university when I was really young. And then we got an Apple II Plus in 79, and I started programming in BASIC and Logo. Grew up very involved with computers. Went to a great free school where I was allowed to really choose my own curriculum and really got to play with computers. I spent 2 or 3 years just noodling on HyperTalk, and then I dropped out of a bunch of universities, 4 universities, and decided to focus on other stuff, programming CD-ROMs and then building commercial Gopher sites and then websites. I was the CIO of an ad agency that turned into a tech services company, CIO of a film house that was doing documentary film but digital editing in the early days of digital editing. I was a field tech for an SGI print prepress integrator, so working with SGI boxes and integrating them with Macs and PCs and learning some Unix stuff. And all this stuff was kind of at the dawn of the web, and you know, figuring out how to use web-based tools and distance communication to assist all this. I was a BBSer and a internet user and so on. And I co-founded a software company called OpenCola that was a peer-to-peer company that was building free software, open source peer-to-peer tools. We raised a bunch of money. We ran into a bunch of legal problems. We ended up involved with EFF, and I left the company to go work for EFF. So that's sort of how I ended up in a very short version, how I ended up here. I right now with EFF, I'm synthesizing some of the stuff that I've done, so stuff that I did before, just before I got involved heavily in tech, where I was, I lived in Central America in Costa Rica in a rural village of Nicaraguan squatters in the north who were refugees from the problems there, you know, the Contra wars, and, you know, dug latrines and built schools and so on. And now through EFF, I'm getting involved at the UN in international development and how IP reform can be used as a way of facilitating international development, and how overbroad IP undermines international development. And so drawing on the experience I had there, and also on the fact that I now speak Spanish as a consequence of having lived in Central America, it's very useful.
So you didn't know Spanish before you moved there?
I knew a little. When I was 17, I dropped out of school and moved to Mexico, to the Baja, and wrote for a while on a little white house on top of a mountain. And I learned some Spanish there. But the village that I lived in the Baja Sur was very Americanized. There were a lot of U.S. military retirees. So it was possible to really get by with English, and I didn't pick up as much Spanish as I should have. But I picked up a lot when I lived in Costa Rica.
So speaking of writing, Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, what was your inspiration?
There wasn't any one specific inspiration. I've been writing since I was a kid. I knew I wanted to write science fiction for a living when I was 12, and I started writing then. I started selling stories when I was about 17, and sold my first novel when I was in my late 20s. I'd grown up going to Disney World. My grandparents are snowbirds. They retired to Florida, and I would go down at Christmas break and visit them. And there's not much to do when you're in, you know, a retirement village in Fort Lauderdale. So we would get in the big land yacht, and we'd drive down to Disney World, and we'd spend a while there. And I would go with my dad too, which was really interesting. My folks, my dad in particular, because my dad was a technocrat. You know, he's as a lot of Marxists who are involved with technology are. You know, he's someone who really believed in kind of improving the world with technology, and Disney was very much about this. And it was very, you know, there are axes on which technocrats, you know, merge, whether they're on the left or the right, whether they're corporatist or anti-corporatist and so on. And that was, it was really, for me, very, very cool to sort of get that analysis. So I was, you know, very involved with Disney. I was very involved with science fiction. I had watched the burgeoning death of scarcity on the internet, where the goods that were of increasing importance, which is to say information goods, were of declining scarcity. And generally speaking, importance and scarcity go hand in hand. You know, it's we don't, although there are things that are non-scarce and important, we don't give them a lot of thought because, of course, they're not scarce, like oxygen, right? It's not as important as it is. You don't spend a lot of time worrying about, you know, global oxygen policy. And yet, you know, bits are of vast and increasing importance, and the scarcity of bits has been in decline now for a decade and is about to rupture. You know, the existence of hard drives that are capacious enough, for example, to store every song ever made, and soon every movie ever made, and not long after that every movie, every song, every word ever written, and network carrying capacity that's large enough to move substantial fractions of that, local device-to-device peer-to-peer networking that's large enough to sync public shares of that stuff essentially means a complete rupture of anything that relies on the scarcity of bits. And so I wanted to write a book about what the end of scarcity might mean and how you might arrange those resources that remain scarce, the scarce resources, in a world where the economics of scarcity had been all but abolished. And so, you know, the fusion of those things, I guess, made down in the Magic Kingdom. So it's done very well. I just actually noticed when I opened a copy the other day that they've gone to another printing without telling me. So they're in the third printing of the paperback now after selling out the hardcover in 8 months. And it's up for the Nebula Award this year, and I'll know on April 30th. I'm going from here back to London, then to Geneva, then back to London, then to a conference in Detroit. I'm going to go back to Toronto for a few days, see my family, and then I'm flying to Chicago for the Nebula Awards. And I'll know if my book won the Nebula Award. If it does, it'll join, you know, a very small and flattering club of first novels that have won the Nebula. The last one, I think, was Neuromancer, so that'd be pretty badass.
But Neuromancer was never really released as an ebook.
Well, no, although Gibson, weirdly enough, experimented both with electronic text and DRM early on. He released a poem called Agrippa, a Book of the Dead, in a conceptual DRM wrapper. The DRM was not conceptual. The DRM was there, but the concept was that you were meant to be able to read it once, and then it would evaporate. And he wanted to make a kind of meta statement in the format about the... the fact that bits are a book written on water and so on and so forth. Of course, the DRM, it's an early parable. The DRM was cracked 12 seconds later and you could download it from Gopher, you know. But Down and Out was released as an ebook. I did a Creative Commons release. It was the first book released under Creative Commons license. More than 500,000 copies have been distributed from my website. Innumerable copies have been distributed from other people's websites, P2P nodes and so on. I don't know how many. Lots have been circulated on mailing lists, posted to news groups, so forth. It's been a good business move for me. It's kind of a three-pronged strategy for me. In the short term, by lowering my cost of customer acquisition to zero, it doesn't matter that I simultaneously lower my per-customer revenue because my customer numbers are very large, 500,000, right? The fact that only 35,000 of them or so bought copies doesn't actually matter. You know, 500,000 over 35,000 copies is not a lot of per-customer revenue, but 35,000 is actually a very high number of customers for a first novel, science fiction novel that comes out in the mid-list. You know, it's itself a very impressive feat, you know, and so it put more money in my pocket than I would have had otherwise. In the long term, I feel like there will be a practice of text that will be entirely electronic, and the practice of paper books will be one that is largely about kind of the artifactness of a paper book, the degree to which it's pretty. So we'll buy them as works of art, but we won't buy paper books. When we need to instantiate paper, we'll instantiate it temporarily and then discard of it. You know, Brewster Kahle is already printing full bleed. Printed spine, covered, coated stock, four color, 100-page books in 10 minutes for a dollar, right? So, you know, instantiating books at home will be trivial, and so we're not going to be selling people books at some point. And when that happens, there will be new market opportunities in the same way that when you stop selling, you know, when a vaudeville ticket stopped being the primary way that you consume music and a radio became the primary way that you consume music, there was more revenue on the table for performers than had ever been there in the age of vaudeville. But the ones who had stamped their foot and crossed their arms and demanded that the world rearrange itself in a more pleasing configuration or they would stop performing ended up driving taxis. And the ones who embraced it, the Gracie Allens, the Groucho Marxes, and so on, who jumped in with both feet and had the best market intelligence about which of the many business models that had emerged around radio was the one that they should bet on and were able to move agile with agility and flexibility into that model. So there's a long-term plan there, too. And in the medium term, there may well be an interregnum during which people stop buying books, but the new business models haven't emerged, and writers will have to have another way of making an income. And traditionally, writers have made substantial portions of their income from things that are related to but not writing per se, so public speaking, writers in residency, lecturing, teaching births, commissioned articles, and so on. And all of those opportunities are directly contingent on the degree to which you're notorious or well-known. And by giving away 500,000 copies of my book, I'm more well known than I would have been if I'd only sold 10,000 copies of my book. So, you know, it's kind of it's none of this is kind of fuzzy headed, patchouli scented info hippiness. This is all about like being a hard nosed entrepreneur who wants to make as much money as is humanly possible off of my creative endeavors, and approaching that in the way that I think is most rational and responds best to the future. And so, you know, I think that it'll work for me. Hope it will.
So do you think a lot of print publishers are going to be driving taxis in a few years?
I don't know. You know, publishing is not printing. You know, as my editor, Patrick Nielsen Hayden at Tor, the senior editor there, that edits the largest science fiction line in the world, says, publishing is making public. Publishing is taking an audience, a text, and connecting it with its right audience. And that's a very specialized skill set that can be readily disambiguated from the skill of arranging for print editions. And I used to work in prepress. I am perfectly capable of arranging for a print edition, right? Getting that print edition into the hands of people, or getting an electronic edition into the hands of the right people, is not a skill that many writers possess, and it's certainly not a skill that's a prerequisite for being a writer who is capable of producing a text with a potential substantial audience. If publishers no longer arrange for print editions, that won't be the end of publishing. It'll just be the end of a certain kind of publishing.
My hand's getting tired, so I'm having to switch hands back and forth here. You've obviously been involved with Boing Boing from its inception.
No. The inception was as a print magazine when I was a teenager. Mark Frauenfelder and his wife Carla Sinclair and some of their mates started a zine called Boing Boing that was doing quite well. And then the major distributor for magazines melted down and took pretty much all the zines in the field with it. They not only melted down owing a lot of these publishers a lot of money, but to the extent that they still had inventory of old magazines, they kept them, right? The receivers in bankruptcy sold them off cheap to pay back the secure creditors, and the publishers, you know, of magazines, Boing Boing among them, being unsecure creditors, didn't receive anything from this, you know. So around the same time, Mark became one of the first managing editors at Wired, and went on to be the first managing editor at Wired Online, and then ended up in the masthead of the Industry Standard and so on, and became quite a successful tech writer. But I think he was restless. He missed writing back, you know, the kind of stuff that he was able to write when he was editing Boing Boing. And so he, you know, Blogger came out and he wanted to fool around with it. He started a Blogger blog and brought Boing Boing back as a blog. And he wasn't posting much, you know, maybe once or twice a day, sometimes once a week. And he had a few readers, you know, 40, 50, sometimes a couple hundred in a day. And then he cracked the Dean Kamen side, what is it called? The Ginger, the scooter,
Segway
story. When no one knew what the Segway, what Dean Kamen had invented, merely that he had invented something that had gotten a lot of capitalization. Mark actually went and looked up the patent applications, figured out what Dean Kamen had made, and wrote a piece about it, and it got on CNN that night. And this was about a year after he'd started it, and it went from like 40 visitors to 7,000 visitors that night. And Mark was going on holiday the next day, and he figured some of those people might come back, and it'd be great if someone was writing something. So he rang me up and said, you know, do you want to guest edit for a while? And so I said, okay. So I guest edited. And when he came back, he said, you did a great job. Why don't you stay around? And then we had Shenny on as a guest blogger, and we kept her. And then Pesca was a friend of Mark's, and he invited him in, and that's how it sort of all happened. But I certainly didn't start with the magazine or with the blog.
Has it been the only time you've really shared your thoughts online?
No, not at all. I mean, I was a BBSer for, you know, a decade.
Did you ever do ISCA?
No, I don't know ISCA. I did Fidonet. I did Fidonet. I did Usenet. I did Pyroto BBSs, which was this old game BBS that I was completely addicted to for years. It was really cool. It was you leveled up by posting messages on BBSs that were highly rated by your peers, and the higher you leveled up, and then so that would give you points, and you could use the points to run commands. One of the commands you could do was attempt to level up, and when you attempted to level up, you'd be asked a trivia question, and if you answered it correctly, you'd level up, and once you leveled up to the top level, you got root. And you could do things like erase all the accounts and reset the system back to zero, which happened every once in a while. They were called earthquakes. And everyone would end up at the bottom again, including the person who'd done this, and you'd all start laboriously climbing. It was really fun.
The reason why I bring up ISCA, that was the BBS that I hung out on, coming from Iowa. It was based at the University of Iowa. And I just discovered the other day that, well, it still exists, but they also take what's being posted in the forums and push it out through RSS feeds.
Oh, cool.
So it's actually transcending the BBS space and entering the general world of the internet.
There's a FIDO to WebBridge now, too. FIDONet to WebBridge. And there's still FIDO, lots of FIDO activity in the former Soviet Union and in Africa, places where phone calls are very expensive. FIDO was really, really well optimized for expensive long-haul phone calls and unreliable long-haul phone infrastructure. And in places where you don't have the internet, the reason is usually that phone calls are really expensive and not very reliable, so FIDO is a good choice there. And the fact that there's now a web-based, you know, bridge into that, there's always been a Usenet bridge for a long time. John Gilmore, who's here, and Tom Jennings and Tim Pozar, when Tim and John were working at the Little Garden, which was the first dial-up ISP that John founded at 16th and Mission in San Francisco, one day basically Tim wrote some code to bridge Usenet into FidoNet. John had previously invented the alt hierarchy for Usenet, and so he was really, you know, he was really expanding what Usenet was for, you know, very quickly. And so he they bridged it in. It was like you know, the day that they you know, hammered in the last spike on the transnational railroad, and now you suddenly had FIDO and Usenet and FIDONet, and the world changed. I remember it that day. You know, I once had the privilege of standing around while Tom and Tim and John reminisced about it, and it was like a shiver went up my back. It was pretty cool. You know, I really remember that day. It was a pretty amazing day in my life.
So what groups were you active in?
Oh, Christ, you know, the science fiction groups and some of the activism groups and so on. I couldn't even name them anymore, you know.
So do you still have a SIG file?
Do I have a SIG file? Yeah, I mean, mostly I have a SIG file. I have about 9. I have an EFF one that has my EFF contact address. I have a personal one. I have a personal one that has my address and my phone number, which I don't sign all my emails with. And then I use SIG files as a way of sending back forum responses. So actually, as a PSA, if anyone is thinking about submitting something for Boing Boing, please don't send it by email. There's a suggest a link form, and I actually have a SIG file. When someone sends me one of these by email, I just choose the SIG file and reply it back, and it just says, you know, you appear to be sending me a link for Boing Boing by email. That's not how you do it. Here's where you go to send me a suggestion for Boing Boing and why I do that and so on. Mostly it's because spreading the work out across all 4 editors makes my life a lot easier and makes their life a lot easier and increases the transparency between the editors about who's posting what, formats the post for easy reposting, makes sure that all the information I need is there, and you know, decreases the amount of duplicate stuff I get and ensures that people read the informative notes about how to submit. Mostly that's about making sure that you describe what it is that you're suggesting and that you why you suggested it. I get way too much email that's just a URL and sometimes even worse, a tiny URL that's had all the semantics ripped out of it, you know. And it's like, it's you know, I get 20,000 pieces of email a day. Most of them are spam, but even when you take the remainder, life is too short. I literally could not click on all those links, so I need people to describe their links. And I might miss some good stuff as a result, but the alternative is I would get nothing done. So,
I think the first time I sent you an email, it was a follow-up to something you'd posted on Wacky Packages. Mm-hmm. It was a while ago, and obviously you've posted many things and you wouldn't remember. But you did respond to it, and I think you actually followed up and credited the response to me. And that was something that I think Boing Boing does very well. They credit religiously, I should say. Is that part of the ethos of the editorial team?
I, if not the ethos, at least the practice. You know, it's part of the house style. And our house style, you know, it evolves slowly. It's, you know, there's no formal enforcement because there's no editor in chief, right? So there's no way to enforce the house style, but it's basically the 4 of us noodle and kind of emerge stuff. But, you know, thanks via update. Mark's been playing lately with reader comment as opposed to update, whether it's all in red or whether it's just the section is in red. Whether we use one of the ones that we read on early was we don't use bold in posts because it makes it easy to find the headlines. The post separator is basically some bold text, right? We don't have a bar or anything that separates the posts. And when you put bold text in a post, it makes it look like 2 posts, and so on. So there's a bunch of that stuff. You know, linking back is sure. You know, I figure one of the things that I find that is personally, I think, where I run into loggerheads with some people who really like reading Boing Boing is Boing Boing for me is how I jot notes to myself, and I'm glad that other people like it, but I often exhaust my interest in a subject before the people who read Boing Boing do, and so having posted about foo, I'll get 10 more suggestions about foo, and I feel like just telling people where they can get more information about foo, you know, which is the via or the thanks or whatever, is actually a pretty good way of managing that, because I'm done with foo. You know, my attention span is notoriously short, so, you know, I don't feel like I work for anyone except me when I write that stuff, and so the fact that some other people would like me to post more about it is not actually very germane. And so I hope to stave off some of that by putting in sort of supplementary or provenance links.
I was kind of jealous. I walked into a Starbucks. It was a couple months ago, and I was walking by a laptop, and the laptop was open to Boing Boing. I'm like, oh, dude, I wanted to say, hey, yeah, I read Boing Boing too, but there's no real way of engaging a conversation that way.
I don't know. That's pretty cool. I've had stuff like that happen just once or twice. I mean, I don't harbor delusions of fame, you know. But I did once. I was working out at an office that I had some shared space in, and it was my first day there, and the guy at the next desk over was saying, "Have you seen this blog called Boing Boing?" And I was convinced it was a put on, actually. And I turned around and I said, "Cut it out." And he's like, "What? What?" Like, I edit Boing Boing. He's like, "You do not." That was pretty funny, but that hasn't happened very often.
So you just kind of you're unassuming. You don't exactly wear it on your sleeve.
Yeah, I don't own a Boing Boing T-shirt or anything.
Are there Boing Boing T-shirts?
I think there's Cafe Press shirts. I think Mark does some Cafe Press shirts. I Cafe Press shirts are, you know, crap. They survive two washings and then they're gonzoed. So I don't own a lot of Cafe Press shirts anymore.
I think Cafe Press does well with mugs, and that's about it.
Yeah, and drinks coasters, but there's a limit to how many of those you can usefully own.
Yes, without looking too strange.
Yeah.
So recently, you know, talking about Boing Boing, I know I caught some conversations that were putting Boing Boing under attack for the amount of advertising mm-hmm. that was being placed on Boing Boing. Mm-hmm. And personally, I don't have a problem with this. You know, I'm an entrepreneur, much like yourself, and I can only imagine the rest of the team. Was there any official reaction, I guess, from the editorial team at Boing Boing on that particular attack?
No, I mean, you know, people are entitled to their opinion. My reaction, so the way that it was kind of phrased was, what's up, what's going on there? It seems very, you know, there's not a lot of transparency into what's going on. Which is very funny because in the same breath it was, well, it's become very visible that Boing Boing has a lot of advertising. Where's their transparency into it? And it's like, well, if it's very visible, then what transparency is lacking? You know, I didn't really quite get what they were about, except I think that what they wanted to say was they I'm not even sure what they wanted to say. I was never clear on what the objection was. So not being clear on what the objection was, I didn't have much of a response to it, except I'm not very clear on what the objection is. You know, I think Boing Boing is noodling around with how much advertising it carries. You know, our posting volume is certainly up now that there's more money in the kitty, and you know, at least my co-editors, I got a day job, so I can't sort of devote more time based on how much money I get. But my co-editors, anyways, who freelance, are able to do more work for Boing Boing. And the advertising is nice, and the money from it is nice. But I tell you, you know, at the word rate I get from Wired or Popular Science or whatever, I could make literally 10 to 20 times as much for the time I spent on Boing Boing. You know, if I'm a whore for doing Boing Boing, I'm the world's cheapest, least entrepreneurial whore, you know.
So, any opportunities that are floating out there in the future? Any things that you're putting together?
Well, I've got a novel coming out in July. Someone comes to town, someone leaves town. That's a contemporary fantasy novel about wireless networking. So it's about a guy who's father is a mountain, his mother is a washing machine. He has three brothers who nest like Russian dolls, one who's a corpse, one who's a mountain, or one who's an island, rather, and one who's precognitive. And he leaves rural Ontario, where he was raised, and he moves to Toronto and ends up in a bohemian neighborhood after a career as a successful serial entrepreneur running a used bookstore, used furniture store, a tin toy store, and so on. And he retires, and he falls in with this bohemian crowd who dumpster dive parts and use them to build Wi-Fi access points that they use to build meshing community wireless networks, and falls in very heavily with them. And as he's engaged in this, the brother that he and the rest of his brothers conspired to murder a decade before comes back from the dead and begins to hunt them. So it's kind of your basic family revenge wireless networking, for, First Amendment network infrastructure, contemporary fantasy love story.
Well, I can tell you, they just added that section in the Barnes & Noble, so I'll know exactly where to find it.
And I'm working on another novel now, and there's a short story collection project I'm working on, and I'm collaborating on a story with a guy named Ben Rosenbaum, who lives, I actually can't remember where he lives in the States now, I think D.C., used to be on the West Coast, and before that in Switzerland, and he's a very good writer. And we're working on a story called True Names. I've been writing stories that have the same stories as famous science fiction novels and stories, same titles as famous stories that kind of try to deconstruct them or analyze them or parody them. And in particular, in respect of the political underpinnings of the techno-political underpinnings of them. So I did one called iRobot. I did one called Anda's Game. That's been picked up by Michael Chabon for his Best American Short Stories, which is funny because I'm not an American, and the story is set in England, but it's going in Bass, which is cool.
So you're not an American. What are you?
I'm a Canadian. I'm from Toronto.
Okay, and you're living in London now.
In London, England. Of all the places I've lived, it's my favorite.
Why?
Very cosmopolitan, very intensely urban. I love the architecture. I love the infrastructure. The city is a great city to get around in. It's a great city to walk in. I love the vibe. As compared to San Francisco, I love the degree of racial harmony. San Francisco is very racially divided, and having grown up in a nice liberal democracy in Toronto, I was very shocked by it and dismayed by it. I love the the social democratic elements of it. I love the fact that there's a great deal of evenness in the wealth distribution as compared to San Francisco, where I often intensely and keenly felt the disparity in my quality of life and the quality of life of the people around me. And I feel that's much less the case in London, where people who are in lower economic strata have state subsidy and so on that helps them, that ensures that everyone has at least a minimum quality standard of living. I love how easy it is to get to the rest of Europe. I do a lot of travel. I travel 3 weeks a month, so I get to see a lot of places, and it's very easy to get anywhere from London. Heathrow in particular has flights to more destinations than any airport in the world. So it's pretty cool.
So of those 3 weeks out of the month, it's okay. It's a great phone ring. It cut off. That's a great, it's just a little WAV file.
Yeah. I got a bunch of Looney Tunes sound effects that I use as ringtones.
Quite unique. So 3 months, or I'm sorry, 3 weeks out of a month, yeah. You're traveling. Is this largely for the EFF?
All for EFF. I mean, sometimes I piggyback some writerly stuff on it, but it's all EFF related.
When you're invited to speak in front of organizations, large organizations, HP, Microsoft, etc., what are you most often asked to talk about?
In particular, it's DRM. When technology firms usually want me to talk about DRM, that's the thing I work on most. Sometimes on international trade and IP issues, which I work on at WIPO a little, at the UN's Intellectual Property Agency, World Intellectual Property Organization. Excuse me.
Someone really wants to get a hold of you. Oh, that's the woohoo, woohoo, that's voicemail.
That's Porky, or not Porky Pig, Daffy Duck, yeah.
So a big cartoon fan.
Yes, very much so, yeah. Roger Rabbit's one of my favorite movies. I talk a lot about DRM and about good responses to DRM. P2P, basically how companies can adjust to the 21st century. I gave a talk last night at the museum, the Sci-Fi Museum, on leading up to the Pioneer Awards, where I talked about two kind of ways of logical fallacies of the technology world. One is one that comes from my family's Soviet history. You know, my dad was born in a refugee camp in Azerbaijan to my grandmother, who'd fled Leningrad, and my grandfather, who'd fled White Russia, my grandmother used to say this, still says, of the Soviet era, that they would say, you know, jam yesterday, jam tomorrow, no jam today. You know, yesterday we had a pretty good. Tomorrow they tell us we'll have a pretty good. Today, not so good. And, you know, yesterday we had terrorism, but we had fundamental civil liberties, due process, the human dignity of not being cavity searched at the airport, and so on. Today we have terrorism. We don't have any of those things. Tomorrow they tell us we won't have terrorism. Not really clear on how we get from no jam today to jam tomorrow. The other one is the South Park Magic Underpants gnomes problem, which is, you know, if you're familiar with the episode, they have a character who his underwear is going missing, and he sees gnomes stealing his underwear in the dead of night. Let's just wait until this goes past. He sees gnomes stealing his underwear in the dead of night. No one believes him, but he eventually tracks them down to their underground lair, where he calls them to account for having stolen his underwear. And they have a big sign on the wall that explains this plan for world domination, and it says, step one, steal underwear. Step two, and it's blank. And step three, profit. And you know, the gnomes keep asking the gnomes, why are you stealing underwear? And they keep saying, well, it will be profitable someday. And they keep asking them to explain it, and they're incapable of explaining it. And they say, well, you know, eventually they get the gnomes to realize that there is no step two on their sign, that step two is blank. And, you know, we have this thinking coming from the Recording Industry Association, where they, you know, step one, go from a world where 80% of the recordings ever made were not commercially available to a world where 100% of them were available through Napster, essentially without having to spend any money on getting them together. Of course, artists weren't getting paid. Step one is respond to that by suing all of the members of your audience who used to buy CDs and have stopped, and then taking all the ones who still buy CDs and treating them like crooks by wrapping your CDs up with DRM that restrict their legitimate expectations and customary uses. Step two, not sure what it is. Step three, a chastened America returns to the mall to buy the CDs that they have given up before. And, you know, pointing this out to businesses that they don't know what step two is important. Because, of course, they're money-making entities. And if they can't get to step three, and, in fact, if step one is keeping them from getting to step three, then they need to rethink it. So I talk a lot about underpants gnomes and jam.
So, you know, putting those two together just creates an interesting mental image. Yes, and gnomes, of course. How do they react to hearing that they're kind of on the wrong track?
Well, you know, they're pretty thoughtful. They want to know. You know, they're often challenged. I think that, you know, what I hear later is that they often take it on board. It makes them rethink some of their strategies. And I kind of hope that some of their engineers or senior people will say, well, look, here's an opportunity that my employer is leaving, is wasting. I should go start a competing entity that, you know, I already, you know, in the case of Microsoft, for example, I have at the expense of Microsoft had a very good apprenticeship in building media players. I know how to make media players. Microsoft's media player sucks because it only plays Microsoft formats and not real and Apple and all the rest of it. Why don't I go make a better media player? And you know, as you were saying, this is something that Glazer did when he started Real, and I think that there are lots of opportunities for companies to come along and start thinking this way. So we'll see what happens.
Do you think we'll ever see a world without DRM?
Absolutely. DRM's junk science, right? I mean, DRM relies on the idea that I can give my infinitely skilled, infinitely resourced attackers the ciphertext, the cipher, and the keys, and hope that they never put them together in a way that I will find that will undermine my business model. DRM has a very high price potentially to make a first copy, but all subsequent copies after the first copy are free, because all you need to do to make that second copy is go to Google and type in movie namespace torrent. You don't need to be elite. You don't need to know how to rip a DVD. You don't need to, you know, the idea that DRM is a speed bump, well, you don't need to go over the DRM speed bump in order to make a copy of a movie. You only need to go over that DRM speed bump the first time. All subsequent ones are trivial. So DRM, being the junk science that it is, will collapse under its own weight. All big lies collapse. You know, we had junk science that ran in the Soviet Union for a century. That was one of the things that tremendously undermined the Soviet Union, Lysenkoism, you know, which was the idea that that for ideological reasons, Stalin and his successors believed in the theories of a guy named Lysenko, who said that you could alter the genome of an entity by altering its somatype. So if you cut off the leg of a frog, and then you cut off its child's leg, and then you cut off its child's leg, eventually you'd end up with a frog that was one leg short. And obviously this doesn't happen. You know, they believe things like weeds would spontaneously transmutate into wheat if treated the correct way and so on. It caused, you know, famine, it caused blight, it retarded Soviet science, and it you know, is one of the, ultimately one of the reasons the Soviet Union collapsed. One of the large reasons is their science was ideological and not grounded in empiricism. Well, DRM is grounded in ideology, right? Wouldn't it be nice if we could extract monopoly rents for activities that people used to engage in for free? And if the laws of physics and information science were different in a way that enabled this? Well, they're not, right? I mean, you know, whether or not you think people should be able to extract monopoly rents for things that you used to get for free, the laws of physics and information science are what they are. And they're not the universe will not reconfigure itself to a more hospitable reconfiguration simply because it would be good for your business plan. And so everyone whose business plan is in any way reliant on this will eventually collapse.
You think even so with hardware DRM?
Yeah, absolutely. A hardware DRM, all hardware DRM, so there's this conceit that hardware DRM is hard to break, right? Well, Bunny Huang, who's the Xbox cracker, showed that hardware DRM is not hard to break. I had a meeting recently with some DRM standards people about this, and they were talking about how mystically hard it was to make and break hardware. And I said, you know, the Xbox hacker, Bunny, he programmed his FPGA that he used to break the Xbox in C, right, and used an FPGA toaster that cost $200 to make an FPGA that cost $2, right? So hardware costs, hardware difficulty is not transcendental. Hardware costs are not prohibitive. Hardware DRM is broken in just the same way software DRM is broken.
So what's it going to take for the companies who are relying on DRM to control, and I use air quotes around the word control, what's it going to take before they're going to see the, as you might put it, the error of their ways?
Well, so you assume that these companies actually use DRM in order to restrict how people make copies of works, and in fact they don't. What these companies seek in DRM is not protection from copying, but protection from competition. Because what DRM does is it gives you what those DRM people call hook IP, which is IP patents or secrets or copyrights that are superfluous to accomplishing the technical task at hand, but that requires that it's proprietary, and so it requires that people who wish to make an implementation take a license, and as a condition of that license, you can restrict the feature set. So, for example, DVD-CCA, who maintain the DRM for the DVDs, the CSS DRM for the DVD, and license that out, DRM, the DVD DRM has been broken virtually since the day it launched. DVD Jan Johansson in Norway, bored teenager, and two of his friends broke it in an afternoon for shits and giggles. But it is unlawful to launch a business that makes use of Jan's discovery, even if you're doing so in a way that's lawful. So if, for example, so it's not unlawful to watch a DVD in any country. Right. Once you've lawfully acquired the DVD, you can watch it in Canada, the United States, Mexico, Europe, and Asia. No matter what region the DVD is in, the DVDs are region coded in a way that restricts which country you watch them in. That's not a law. That's a business model. You don't enter into a contract in which you promise not to watch it in another country, and they have no technical legal right to stop you from doing it. They have a technical mechanism to stop you from doing it, and because circumventing that technical mechanism is unlawful, then it becomes impossible to offer people lawful tools in the market. So you could make, for example, a DVD player that reverse engineered, that used the reverse engineered DVD DCSS code to rip open a DVD and play it back regardless of what region it was in, but then wrap it back up again before it could be copied. So you're still stopping people from making infringing copies. You're not stopping people from watching it in different countries. That's perfectly legal, but the act of circumventing is per se unlawful. And so a competitor who wished to enter the marketplace with this perfectly legitimate technology will find himself in a world of legal hurt. A recent example of this is a company called Kaleidoscape that makes DVD jukeboxes, very expensive, $27,000 DVD jukeboxes that hold about 100 DVDs. And you put the DVDs in, it rips them to a hard drive. It adds DRM to the video objects on the hard drive, such that they can't be freely recopied. Right? It locks them up. But what it does is it what it does is it makes copies on the hard drive in a way that the studios wish you couldn't have. They don't want people, for one reason or another, to grow accustomed to being able to watch movies off their hard drives that originate on a DVD. They want people to only be able to watch them from the platter itself. And so they're suing them, right? They're suing them for having added a feature, right? And that's what it does. And of course, the DVCCA isn't just staffed by the studios. It's staffed by any number of Vichy nerds who have sold out our interests. They're representatives from technology companies. And they've sold out our interests and in exchange for, from the studios, a guarantee that they will become a party to any lawsuit against any competitor who adds new functionality in a way that might threaten their ability to go on selling their legacy inventory. What they want, this is something that I heard from Andy Sidos, the guy who wrote the broadcast flags, president of Fox, at one of the broadcast protection discussion group meetings where the broadcast flag was hammered out. He said, what we're looking for is a polite marketplace. Right, we want a marketplace where before you do something that disrupts our business, you seek our permission and give us an opportunity to come up with a response. Right? Well, there's a name for that, and it's not a marketplace, right? It's called central planning. And, you know, as a child of Marxists, I'm in no position to condemn it as out of hand, but it certainly isn't capitalism, right? Capitalism is about competition when you don't want it. So I think that what it's going to take is really effective competitors and probably antitrust rules being brought to bear, and not companies saying, oh gosh, DRM technologies have failed to restrict copying. I don't think they care about restricting copying. Look at Apple iTunes, right? Apple iTunes has two technologies they have that restrict the way you use that you gain access and use the work. One is a conditional access system. That's the system that won't allow you to download a song until you transfer 99 cents from your bank account to theirs. The other is a DRM system. That's the system that once you've downloaded the music restricts what you can do with it. No one has ever bought an iTunes for the DRM. Right? No one ever said, well, as between the version of the song that I can download for free from Kazaa and the version that I can get from Apple, the thing that makes me buy it from Apple is the DRM. Right? DRM is not a feature. You can't put it on the box. Now with fewer liberties is not a sales pitch. Right? Now, the conditional access system works. The conditional access systems aren't junk science because conditional access systems only concern themselves with what you do tomorrow, right? So DRM is worried with what you do with the media you got yesterday. Conditional access system, if you broke Apple's conditional access system, you could download as many songs as you wanted today. Tomorrow, they could patch it and go back to charging you money. Right, it wouldn't be a tremendous crisis for them. Whereas if DRM was actually critical, if restricting how people use the files once they paid for them was actually critical to Apple's business model, then Apple's business would have collapsed within moments of it launching. Because, of course, you can download every song in the iTunes Music Store catalog for free from Kazaa without restriction. Right. So clearly, Apple's business model, and by extension the recording industry's business model, does not lie in restricting what copies you can make after you've lawfully acquired the work. However, having the DRM in Apple's iPods and iTunes Music Store means that if anyone adds functionality to iTunes or adds functionality to the iPod, they have a cause of action against them in court. So when Real adds new firmware to the iPod that lets you play the songs that you bought from the Real store to your iPod, Apple has a cause of action against Real and can rattle its legal sabers against them. Well, this is not in our interest as iPod owners. In fact, you know, Apple released these very funny press statements when Real did this. They said, Real has broken into the iPod. Real has broken into your iPod. And it's like, whose iPod did they break into? Mine's been in my pocket the whole time, right? I think Real broke into Real's iPod. I think Real bought an iPod in the store and broke into that one. That's not usually considered illegal. That's called reverse engineering. It's part of the legitimate practice of technology businesses since the earliest days, you know? There's a famous lawsuit fought about this in the 50s where IBM used to charge monopoly rates for peripherals on their mainframes, right? If you wanted a printer or a keyboard or whatever, all the bits that would, you know, Whole Earth card readers, all the rest of it. And they used to charge very high rates and they would sell the mainframe slightly below cost and with the expectation that they could get money in the door by charging 5,000% markups on these things. And Hitachi went into business cloning IBM parts, right? They'd make you a Hitachi printer, Hitachi terminals, and so on, that were a fraction of the cost. And IBM sued them, and they lost, right? Because the court said that there's a compelling public interest in letting people clone and make interoperable technologies, right? And they said even if IBM will, as a result of this, go out of the mainframe business, that's tough. Someone else will fill that void. But the need to protect your loss leader business model doesn't prevent someone else from cannibalizing your profit margin by offering your loss by offering your profitable items at loss leader margins. Right? That's just not a right that you have. Gillette may give away the handles and sell the blades, but they don't have the right to stop someone else from giving away the blades. And Apple, by adding DRM to iTunes, gets the right to prohibit Real for making iTunes players. That's what DRM does for you, because DRM, it's against the law to break DRM, even if what you're doing is lawful, and that's what DRM gets you, is the ability to sue your competitors effectively. IBM wasn't able to do this with Hitachi. Now, if that happened today, if, for example, you were making broadcast flag compliant television devices, which is what IBM was doing, essentially they were making main devices, and I wanted to make an output for that, a recorder, a DVD recorder, and I didn't get your permission and broke the DRM on your output in order to do this. You know, when Hitachi broke the obfuscation on IBM's outputs, it was lawful. But doing that today is unlawful because of rules that restrict breaking DRM.
So do you think it's all going to boil down to, we can sue you?
Well, I think what it's all going to boil down to is finding an antitrust regulator with a great big fire axe who walks into these smoke-filled rooms where they start where they make these DRM plans and starts cutting off heads. I think that's what it's going to take.
But with as much money as is involved with this industry, is it going to take someone with strong character?
Well, sure, but I mean that's what antitrust is for. Antitrust is for breaking up giant, extremely profitable companies, right? Antitrust, by definition, antitrust regulators don't go after small companies that don't have a lot of influence. They go after railroad barons.
How far in the future do you think that's going to happen?
Well, what I expect will happen is you'll see a couple of the IT companies defect, right, or the telecoms companies. The IT companies, IT is a $600 billion industry. Media, you know, Hollywood and the music industry are a $60 billion industry. So, they're 1,000 times larger, IT. And telecoms is 1,000% larger, rather. And telecoms is 10 times larger, again, it's a $6 trillion industry. Right? So telecoms can buy and sell out of pocket. Now, right now, telecoms is acting like they owe their business to the studios, and the studios should get to design cell phones, right? You should be required to put copy restriction in cell phones that can play music. And the IT industry is acting like they should be letting the Hollywood and the music companies call their shots too. But one or more of them will defect. And when one or more of them defects, then the antitrust sham will be revealed for what it is, where you have they'll say, look, you know, we've been in these smoke-filled rooms for the last 5 years trying to sell out our customers' interests with the promise that we would get a great reward for it. We've decided to go it on our own, and we'll turn states. You know, if in exchange for knowing that our wildly profitable media player that plays everyone's media and not just the media that we're allowed to play, our wildly profitable video player, our wildly profitable media technology is lawful, we will happily turn on our competitors and on the studios and take on after them. A friend of mine who's a law professor, Tim Wu, we grew up with in Toronto, teaches at the University of Virginia, and I had a really interesting conversation a little while ago, and he said, you know, economists understand this problem really well. There's a well-understood phenomenon among economists that the companies that lobby most effectively are the ones that represent industries that are in decline, because companies from really competitive industries if they stop running to go to Washington and waste some time bribing a lawmaker, their competitors will scoop an advantage on them. It's only those industries that are in decline, those industries that are, you know, about to fail, that can actually, where you can actually gather the five old men who are the last ones left standing in a room and say, look, we'll have a gentleman's compact. No one screws anyone else while we all go to D.C. together and seek some special dispensation.
Well, Corey, it looks like you've probably spent enough time with us, and I certainly appreciate the time that you've spent. And
absolutely. Let me just check and see when my panel is. Okay, I've got another.
It's okay. You probably want to take a breather, and I'm sure talking to me hasn't been the most exciting point in the day.
It's just fine. I don't mind at all. So good luck with this.
Thanks, Corey. It'll be up soon.
The Windows Media stream for the live broadcast of The Chris Perillo Show is provided by Limelight Networks. Listen to the live Chris Perillo Show in Windows Media Player. Download the latest version of the player for Mac and Windows users at Microsoft.com/Windows Media.